I'm George Uriello from the Department of History at the University of Warwick and the Global History and Culture Center, and I'm here today with Rosemary Krill, who is Senior Curator at the Asian Department at the Victoria and Albert Museum. And this is part of a series of podcasts on global material culture, part of the Warwick Knowledge Center, and it comes out of the activities of a research network on global material culture, sponsored by the Arts and Humanities Research Council, that is a collaboration between the University of Warwick and the Victoria and Albert Museum and Bilgi University in Istanbul and the Peabody Essex in Salem, Massachusetts. Rosemary, we are now here in your department and we are admiring a wonderful piece of cloth. Can you tell us what it is?
Yes, it's a piece of cotton cloth done in the complicated technique of mordant dyeing and resist dyeing in a technique that's usually known to us as chintz. And it's something that was exported from India in large quantities to many parts of the world, but especially we're talking today about this piece which was exported to Europe, probably to Britain in the 18th century.
Now, explain to us what, from a technological point of view, how it was made. Is this printed? Is this painted? And when you say mordants, what are mordants?
It's a plain white cotton, plain woven fabric. And the design, although it's very, it does have a repeat, it is not actually printed. There is no printing on this piece. It is all hand drawn with a very simple tool called a kalam, which just means a reed or a pen. The outlines are drawn with this pen. There may have been a printed, a repeat that was printed on with some fugitive substance just to give the artist a guide to the design and to keep it regular. What we see now is all hand-drawn. So that's the outline. Mordant dyeing is something particularly used for red colours, and these wonderful reds that we see in the export chintzes are produced by the interaction of a chemical called a mordant, which just means something that bites into the cloth. And in this case, with the red dye, it's usually derived from the mineral alum, the same thing that we get aluminium from. And so the alum mordant is dissolved in water, which forms part of the dye bath for the red dye, which in this case is formed from the roots of a plant called chai, C-H-A-Y, which is found particularly on the Coromandel coast of southeast India, and that's partly what contributes to the unique quality of these textiles, the wonderful richness and fastness of the red dyes.
Now, the chemical composition tell us that this comes from India, but are there other clues that tell us that this is an Indian object?
Yeah, that's a good point, because so much about it is derived from Western design. I mean, like, for example, the upper part is clearly a Western sort of Rococo-style floral pattern, and the lower part shows Europeans indulging in various activities in rather Western style scenery and decorative motifs. So if you just looked at it, it would be quite hard to know that it was actually made in India. And really the only main reasons that we do know that it comes from India are, as you say, the technical aspects, the fact that it's on Indian cotton, the fact that the dyes are very much Indian dyes, but also the way that the Indian craftsman has taken those Western motifs and adapted them through his own imagination, if you like. He hasn't just copied a Western design that might have been sent out by, for example, the East India Company. It's been sort of filtered through both his, you might say, his eye and his hand. I mean, that an Indian craftsman would not just replicate straight a Western design. It's very much a sort of hybrid way of an Indian interpreting the Western motifs that we see on the piece.
Indian calico printers and cotton producers in general were producing goods and objects for a variety of markets around Asia and beyond Asia. In what ways is this specifically for the European market, and how is it different from someone that they might have produced, I don't know, for Japan or for Southeast Asia?
Well, the first thing is that it is made, obviously, to be made into a petticoat or a skirt to be worn by a Western woman. And the whole piece is predetermined, if you like. The design is obviously in the format of a petticoat, which would have been worn under an open-fronted Western dress. Usually with these petticoats of the 18th century, you get a deep border at the hem with one type of design, and then the upper part of the skirt has a less dense, more open pattern, as in the case of this large fragment. So partly that's usage. Another aspect is that clearly it draws on 18th century motifs which would appeal to the Western market. These would have no resonance, no appeal at all for a market in, say, Thailand or Japan. The Indian craftsman excelled at making things targeted at specific markets, and they had been instructed, probably by the East India Company or by merchants, to tailor the design to something that would be familiar but also new and interesting to a Western market.
Am I correct that the Europeans in particular like very white backgrounds, uncluttered backgrounds?
Yes, that's true. Most of the things made for the British market in particular do have this rather beautiful sort of expanses of white fabric on which the deep red and blue designs would really stand out. It appears from correspondence that the Dutch were rather fond of red backgrounds, so they liked a deeper palette, but the British and perhaps also the French preferred this white ground.
Now, is it common to have representations of, in this case, we suppose they are Europeans, on their horses and ladies holding flowers and holding hands with their partners? Is this something common, or is it quite a unique object?
It is surprisingly, if not common, quite widespread that you get these images of Westerners depicted on chintzes as well as some embroideries for export. Although we recognise them as 18th century Europeans, partly through their dress and how the things they're doing, like there's one man here playing a viola da gamba and another one shooting with a very Western style gun. But they, like the design in general, they're very much interpreted by the Indian craftsmen. So they have a very sort of exotic look, and I'm sure they would have seemed exotic even to the Western consumers of this piece.
For sure. You know, I've never seen a horse with flowers, patterned with flowers on the tail. It's absolutely, absolutely fantastic. Do we have any other example of representation of human figures for other markets rather than Europe?
You do get human figures on chintzes like this, not for export, but for the domestic market. There is a group of beautiful pieces, we think probably done for the Islamic courts of the Deccan, perhaps Golconda in the 17th century. And they're covered with human figures, mostly taken from Iranian manuscript paintings. But that's a very different type of market. But those are the only ones I can think of that have human figures.
I suppose the peculiarity of this is also the fact that they are kind of everyday activities. They kind of represent an everyday. And I wonder what was the meaning for Europeans going around, you know, and showing themselves in their own clothing. We are now used to the idea because we have t-shirts with representations of faces and so on. It might be Obama smiling at us, but it is actually quite a peculiar thing.
It is. And to have, yes, to walk around, as you say, with a petticoat with pictures of Europeans taking tea is indeed a very strange thing. And I do slightly wonder whether they fully recognised these figures as Europeans taking tea, because they've become so altered by the hand of the Indian craftsman. It may be that the Western consumers, or the lady who wore this, maybe she didn't quite identify with the people shown in the fabric, who indeed have undergone quite a transformation, and I think she may just have thought they were Indians, perhaps, or some other exotic creature, rather than thinking this is us on my petticoat.
It's absolutely marvellous. Apart from red, this cloth has also a lot of blue.
Yes, the red and blue were really the sort of key colours that made these Indian chintzes so desirable, really, because the Indians were masters at both the mordant dyeing process for red, but also the resist dyeing process that was necessary for indigo to make this wonderful deep blue. And indigo, of course, is something that has been associated with India for millennia, and they really are the masters of indigo dyeing. And because indigo is such an effective dye, it basically dyes everything it touches. And so in the sort of opposite way to the mordants, you have to cover everything you don't want to be blue with what we call a resist to stop the dye touching that fabric. Usually in pieces like this, it would be wax. So all of this piece that is not blue has at one stage been covered with wax, and the whole thing has then been immersed in a vat of indigo to form the blue parts, and the wax is then boiled off to reveal the undyed background.
And am I correct that Europeans then discover a process by which they can actually pencil in the blue?
Yes, there's still quite a lot of discussion about that. And pencil was another word, as it happens, for the brush at that time. So they were actually, you know, brushing on the indigo. And we do get some 18th century Indian chintzes in which the indigo has clearly been applied on the surface rather than vat dyed. But it tends to be very small areas, and the indigo is rather pale. So I think it wasn't such an effective process. But yes, I mean, like making synthetic reds, you know, this was something that the Europeans were enthusiastically trying to copy from the 18th century onwards.
In terms of technological process, this is a rather complicated object, in the sense that you mentioned that first of all you might have had the blue by waxing all the areas that are not blue, and then you might have the application of the red. So it's a series of different stages. Does it mean that this is a very expensive thing?
Not necessarily. Although, as you say, it would have taken a long time to make this, and there are a lot of different stages. Indian textiles coming into Britain were still remarkably cheap in comparison to the real sort of luxury fabrics like imported silk, for example. So the relative cheapness of a cloth like this meant that, for the first time, people who were less well off could participate in this new fashion and could really sort of revitalize what they wore and how they furnished their homes.
I also see this object as also what looks like a patch to me, a little area in which the design is different. Do we know that how that came about?
We don't. I mean, it's obviously been used. This is not an unused object. It's had a life. It's quite worn, and maybe it got burned, maybe somebody dropped something on it, but this has clearly been taken perhaps out of a completely different chintz. I don't know that quite matches the rest of the pattern. And they've very neatly patched this hole with another piece of chintz, and that happens quite often. You see that quite frequently.
Rosemary, thank you so much for sharing with us such a wonderful object that is now preserved at the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Thank you.